Does the thought of going to work make you feel exhausted? Do you find it hard to get anything done? Do you get upset at coworkers over little things? These are classic signs of burnout. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we continue our series, Iowa at Work, with a conversation about job burnout. We'll find out what it is, why it happens, what it costs us, how to deal with it, and how to keep it from happening to you. I'll talk with a burnt-out banker turned bartender, then business professor Ian Crawford, leisure studies professor Ben Honeycutt, and a nurse who is working to prevent other nurses from burning out. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. All this month on Mondays on Talk of Iowa and River to River, we've been exploring different aspects of the workplace in Iowa for our summer series, Iowa at Work. We're going to be concluding the series today at noon on River to River with a conversation about dangerous jobs. This hour, something all too many of us deal with, job burnout. Chuck Wheeler was a successful commercial lender, but his job changed dramatically in 2008, and he's here with us from Des Moines to tell us his story. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, how are you today?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Now, you spent about 25 years in the banking business, becoming a commercial lender. Tell me a little bit about what you did.
Well, we would work with businesses small to what they call mid-market, where they might need anything from, you know, a small line of credit of about $50,000 up to about the $10 million mark and everything in between.
Before 2008, did you like your job?
Yes, I did. I liked it a lot. I'd worked my whole career to get to that point.
Now, in 2008, of course, the economy changed dramatically, and that changed your job a great deal. What was the change for you?
Well, absolutely. It changed everything. As things started crumbling, you know, both locally and nationwide, it doesn't matter what, you know, that I was at Bank XYZ. It affected all banks. The lending was tightened up a lot. And in that particular scenario, I was just like any other salesperson, except I sold, you know, the hottest commodity, money. And with everything tightening up, you really weren't able to, you know, make your sales and meet your quotas and earn what you had become accustomed to.
All right. So it was a money thing for one thing, but also it took an emotional toll because of the relationship you had with the people that you were or weren't lending money to. Explain that to me.
Well, when you get up to the mid-market level, you know, the sales cycle can be anywhere from 60 to 120 days. Say you had a business that, you know, find you somehow magically, and we'd get to talking and you'd show me around your business. And it's been my experience that most business owners are prouder to show you their business than they are to even talk about their family. So you would, you know, they take great pride in what they've accomplished. And then you, you know, after a week or so, you uncover what needs they may have and start to put together a package. And it's not like doing a car loan. You have to, you know, really get in bed with them and go back, you know, 5, 10 years to find out how stable the company is. And so over the process, you become pretty darn good friends with your prospect and hopefully customer. And then, you know, you wouldn't be putting in this kind of effort if you didn't think that the deal would stand a chance of getting approved. But more often than not, after 2008, it would go to a loan committee, and they would, you know, give it thumbs down, and then you're stuck in the awkward position of having to tell your prospective client that, sorry, and then they come back with, oh, but what if you did this and this, and what they don't know is we've already, you know, I've already looked at it from this angle and that angle and that angle, but the bottom line is I had to deliver a no. And from 2008 to about last year, I was delivering a no about 80 to 90% of the time. So you invest a lot of time and energy, and you sincerely get to like the people you're working with, but the no's were starting to get to me.
How did it change how you felt about going to work? I mean, you mentioned that you weren't making as much money as you were before, but you were still considered to be very successful in your field. It wasn't like you didn't have a nice office and nice place to work, but how did it start to change how you felt?
Well, like I said, you get emotionally invested in, your prospective clients. And, the last 4 or 5 years, I drive to work with just I'd start out okay, and then, the closer you get to work, I'd get a terrible stomach ache. And by the time I was pulling into my parking spot, I'm not going to say it was unbearable, but it was really irritating to have a stomach ache every day when you're going into work. It seemed to never go away. And yeah, I did have, all lenders have a base salary. And when you're not lending money, you get, accustomed to living to your base salary. And I've been in the business forever. I've taken care of a lot of people. By and large, it really doesn't matter what you make, because at the end of the month, everybody still has about the same amount of money left over, and that's zero after paying their bills. So it's just a question of adaptability to, make the necessary changes where you need to in your own personal budget and live accordingly.
So you felt you had that stomach ache every day going in, but you also feel like you were really there were significant changes to your health that would have really long-term effects if you kept going, right?
Absolutely. I got out of it about a year ago today, and I know that because it was my birthday then, and it's my birthday today, and I knew I had to make a change. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I knew I couldn't go on doing what I, had spent the last 25 years, hopefully, trying to succeed at and retire from. Since that time, I'm down about 40 pounds. Emotionally, I'm way better off than I was. I don't have the bigger, when you deal with, there's different levels of stress. And when you're dealing with people's companies and you, probably shoulder, not just me, but anybody in the business, shoulders a little too much empathy for what's going on, that's when it starts wearing down on you. And just, I can look in the mirror now and I look better. I feel better. My wife likes me more.
And when you decided to make a change, you decided you just couldn't go into work anymore. Now you're a bartender. How did you decide to become a bartender after spending so many years in commercial lending?
Well, I sat at home for a few months and was a slug, feeling sorry for myself, wondering if, the first thing you do is think, okay, I need to stay on the same career path. But with the way people apply for jobs today online, you could send in a resume and never get a decline letter. It's really frustrating. And so I was getting more and more frustrated. My wife finally asked me, when was the last time you were actually happy going to work? And in the 80s, I lived in San Diego, and I was a bartender. I said, well, probably when I was bartending in the 80s, she said, well, then go get a bartending job. And it was because of her spurring me on to go do it that is the reason I, do it today.
And you're happy?
Oh, I'm very happy. I went from a 90-day sales cycle to about a 90-second sales cycle. I'm still selling. It's just a different product.
And are you working full-time?
Yeah, but my full-time can work into just 4 days a week. So I still have I get a day off during the week, and I have my Saturday and Sunday off to be with my wife. And, my employer, he's real good about making sure that I'm off on Saturday and Sunday, because there is, we're all older and kind of set in our ways, so we were used to seeing each other quite a bit. But she's adapted, I've adapted, and it's working out real well, I'd say.
And I don't really know what the economics are of bartending or commercial lending, but I have to think you took a pretty big pay cut to be a bartender. In spite of that, it still feels like it was the right choice?
Well, it gets back to where we originally were talking about, living off your base salary, which is, what they give you to get by on until you start closing deals. I've lived off my base for 4 or 5 years, so I was already used to making less money. So it really wasn't that big of a transition at all.
Well, Chuck, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Chuck Wheeler was a successful commercial lender. He decided he could no longer go to work in that job, and he became now a successful bartender in Des Moines. This hour, we're talking about job burnout as we conclude our summer series, Iowa at Work. And with me now is Ian Crawford. He's an assistant professor of management and organization in the Tippie College of Business at the University of Iowa. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, when you listen to Chuck's story, we talked in the beginning of the show about some of the classic signs of burnout, the feeling of exhaustion, those stomach aches sound like one of the classic signs. Is this a story that you hear a lot?
Yeah. I mean, the classic descriptors of people who feel burned out is the sense of exhaustion, not just physical exhaustion, but emotional exhaustion as well. And you could hear that in Chuck's story. Also a sense of cynicism or pessimism. You just simply lose your optimism about the future. This sense of feeling a complete lack of personal or professional accomplishment is also a big sign of burnout. And then, of course, the physiological health problems, definitely those all accompany those feelings of burnout.
And burnout, how big a problem is it in our workforce today, if you can kind of generalize for us?
Oh, I don't know if I have exact estimates or statistics. I think it's a pretty broad problem. I think almost every job has conditions that can lead to burnout. I don't have specific numbers, but I think everyone in any job can be susceptible to burnout.
We're going to take a short break here in a moment, and we're going to bring Ben Honeycutt into the conversation, who's a professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa and author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. And we'll talk more about the working world and work-life balance in this country and burnout, why it happens, what it is, what we can do to deal with it, and what we can do to prevent it as well. We also want to hear your stories this hour. Is this something that you've experienced? Have you experienced job burnout? How did you cope? Did it lead you to find a second career, to pursue another pathway? We'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send your email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. With me this hour, Ian Crawford, Assistant Professor of Management and Organization in the Tippie College of Business at the University of Iowa. And also, as I mentioned, Ben Honeycutt, Professor of Leisure Studies at the University of Iowa, will be joining us in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa
Take
Public Radio.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we continue our summer series, Iowa at Work, and this hour we're talking about job burnout. We'd love to hear your stories as well this hour. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Ian Crawford, Assistant Professor of Management and Organization in the Tippie College of Business at the University of Iowa. And also with us this hour, Ben Honeycutt, Professor of Leisure Studies at the University of Iowa and author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. Ben, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Charity.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for being here today. And before the break, Ian and I were talking about some of the classic signs of burnout. And I know that the definition of burnout is something that you're interested in well as well. Is there something else you'd like to add to that definition?
I think Ian covered it fairly well, all of the things that I've found. International statistical classification of diseases from the World Health Organization does list burnout as one of a disease. And the symptoms or the dimensions of the disease, what Ian talked about, exhaustion, cynicism, and inefficiency, those are the big three. For me, the cynicism, a loss of faith, somehow is for me a strong indication of what burnout is. We no longer believe We no longer believe as strongly as we did that work can be the answer to our questions as human beings, and we begin to look elsewhere. Our guest, Chuck Wheeler from Des Moines, I think is representative of a larger phenomenon. Amy Saltzman not long ago wrote a book called Downshifting. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a fairly popular book in which she described this trend, perhaps, of people with highly stressful jobs moving down, downshifting, going to jobs that are less rewarding in terms of financing, but less pressured. Finding bartender jobs. One of my favorite couples live in North Carolina in the mountains and go back from high-pressure jobs in Los Angeles to an orchard in the mountains of North Carolina, which is sort of my dream for retirement. But that sort of thing is, I think, a widespread. Doesn't have to be associated with downshifting, but just a reevaluation of how dominant work is in our lives, right, and a looking around for alternatives.
Let's talk about where job burnout comes from, because I think that there are multiple sources for it. And Ian, can you weigh in a little bit on that? And we've talked about stress. Stress clearly is a factor here. What are some of the other common factors?
Well, and it's important to recognize for a long time we've thought of stress as just bad, that we don't want stress in our jobs. More recent research I've done shows that people actually differentiate different types of stress. There's certain stressful job demands that people evaluate as, if I work at these, you know, they can actually result in growth and accomplishment and learning and mastery, and I can achieve things that I want to in life. Some examples of these are having challenging job tasks or interesting work to do, having a high level of job responsibility. Surprisingly, even to some extent, having deadlines to work towards actually can be motivating to help people get things done. There's a different kind of stress, though, that really, when people evaluate these demands, these are the types of things that just block or hinder or get in the way of you being able to accomplish anything at all. Things like having a lot of ambiguity in your job. You don't know what it is you're supposed to be doing. Or having conflict in your roles where you have conflicting demands that there's no way you can satisfy both. Having complete role overload where you have way more work to do than you could possibly get done in a reasonable amount of time. Organizational politics and power struggles in companies, red tape, bureaucracy, hassles, simply just missing or not having the right equipment or having it be defective, and also threats of job insecurity. All of these types of stressful demands are really the ones that tend to result in a lot of burnout, because people feel like there's no way that these things are going to actually help me grow or learn or achieve things in my job.
No way to succeed.
Exactly.
In what you're doing.
I think you heard a lot of that in Chuck's story, was that after the economic crash, there was just no way for him to achieve his goals. And in particular, one of the biggest roadblocks for him was the loan committee he talked about prior to 2008. He didn't have to have these approvals go through, or if they were, they were going through. And after 80 and 90% denials, I mean, I would throw my hands up too, saying no matter how much time and energy he invests in his clients, and he clearly did loads of that, there was just no way to accomplish those goals. And for that reason, it's clear to see why that would be so demotivating and result in such burnout.
Absolutely. And Ben, do you want to add to that?
Well, I think in addition to the more psychological, perhaps, parts of job burnout, I think there's a very real element of simply how long we work. Jobs are not only occupying more and more of our psychic living room, our energy, but more and more of our actual time. Free time is, which I've written about for a while, has been decreasing. Working hours expanding. A recent Gallup poll shows that the average working hours, I can't find my notes now, about 47% of us are working around 40 hours. But there's a significant population of 20% working over 60 hours, so that the average working hour in America, working week in America, is about 47. Figuring all of these sorts of things. And so the people in management and who have good jobs typically are those who are working 60 hours and more. That is a factor, I think, a strong factor in burnout.
You just get exhausted.
Exactly.
You can't keep that up forever.
Yes, it's physically harmful. In Japan, they have, and still have, and talk about and write about, you can get life insurance against a disease called karoshi, which is quite literally working yourself to death. You can really get insured in Japan against working yourself to death. It is physically harmful, not just working yourself to death, but blood pressure, weight, all of those things figure into something that is harmful, that is pathological.
Now, burnout is pretty common across all job sectors, but what are some of the kinds of jobs that tend to lead to burnout more quickly or more severe burnout? Ben, do you want to?
Well, human services and for nurses and so forth. The people who are dealing, as Chuck was, dealing with people in very close human relation jobs that you want to establish personal relations with these people, but the necessities of the job require not being a friend, saying no to someone you get to like and talk to about loaning money and so forth. So that's takes a heavy emotional toll.
And Ian?
Yeah, I just add to that. I think those human service jobs that require a lot of person-to-person contact, where if you think about what a lot of people hope to have in a job is a sense of meaning where you can make a difference in someone else's life, and in occupations where you find yourself in the position a lot of times where you're actively not doing that, or you feel like you have to deliver that type of bad news to a customer, to a client, to a patient. Experiencing that negative feedback repeatedly over long periods of time, I think, takes its toll.
Well, and I can see where there would be sort of two big different kinds of jobs where you would get that kind of feedback. And one would be, we talked a little bit about bad management and, getting negative feedback, office politics, that kind of thing. But I think about those people who go into a field. I grew up with an elementary school counselor as a mother, and she was, so dedicated to helping kids. But if you see case after case of abuse or neglect, that's got to take a terrible, terrible toll on your psyche, because you can't fix all of those problems as much as you want to.
Yeah, definitely. I think the ability to really see how you make a difference in the world, whether you make that difference one life at a time, and then to feel repeatedly like, I just cannot make a difference. There are so many cases that I can't help. And to have a ratio of, I can't help and I can't make a difference be much higher than the cases when I do feel like I did make a difference. It can be demotivating. I mean, even in my own job as a professor at the university, I teach over 600 students a year. And overwhelmingly, the number of students that want to complain to me about the bad things I've done or how I haven't helped them earn the grade they wanted is much higher than those who felt like, wow, this was really applicable to my life and I can see how this is going to make a difference and I love the things you taught.
Or at least much higher than the students who are going to tell you.
Exactly.
That. People are much more motivated to complain than they are to compliment.
Which is so true. And as humans, we're much more attuned to the negative instances of feedback than we are to the positive, even though the positive in actuality might be much greater. And so I think part of personally dealing with burnout is finding a way to train yourself to pay more attention to the number of times that you did make a difference and that you did have an effect, and help that put in perspective the number of times where you feel like you can't make a difference.
We're talking about job burnout this hour. With me, Ian Crawford, Assistant Professor of Management and Organization at the Tippey College of Business at the University of Iowa, and Ben Honeycutt, Professor of Leisure Studies, also at the University of Iowa. He's also the author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And one of those fields with a lot of burnout is the service sector. Shelley in Iowa City worked in the service sector. Hello, Shelley.
Hi.
Hi, what's your story?
Well, I waited tables for about 10 years or so in all kinds of different restaurants around Iowa City. And a lot of the thing I got a lot of was blatantly racist customers who didn't want me touching their food. And after a while, first managers are like, oh, I'm sorry, sir, I'll get you another server, which they kind of have to do to not upset the customer. But that gets you after a while.
Yeah, definitely.
And there's nothing you can do to make them happy. And then you have customers blatantly lie about you, and then get to the point where going to work is just like you have no choice. you have to go to work. You can't just say, I don't like this job and quit, you know, if you don't have a lot of money. But it's physically and emotionally taxing to the point where you can't handle anything anymore. And I don't think people realize when they go out in public how their behavior affects the people that wait on them.
And did you get to a point where you felt like you just physically couldn't do it anymore?
I got ill when I had to go to work. I got physically ill. I would get the shakes, you know, sometimes I would throw up. Like, it was awful. And I eventually, like I had no choice, though. I had to go to work. And I would cry all the time. And you know, you can't be effective if, like, you know, when you go to work, you're going to get emotionally abused. But essentially what waitressing is, you know, you allow people to emotionally abuse you and you smile and say thank you.
Oh, Shelley. Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today. And again, Ian, I can imagine that's the kind of story you hear a lot, especially in the service sector.
Yeah. One of the best predictors to helping avoid instances like that that management have under their control is a sense of support and autonomy that they give to their employees. You know, in this setting, support is this sense of freedom to be who you are, and to be given the space to be who you are and treated with dignity. And, you know, when that doesn't happen, like she said, it's incredibly draining. I mean, it's emotional abuse. And so if a management team sees things like that and steps in and says, you know, we support you in who you are and the way our customers treated you is absolutely out of bounds. And if anything ever like that happens again, let us know immediately, because we would rather throw out a customer like that than to have you continue to endure that. You know, I read a story about a restaurant where there was a racial incident where a black gentleman was in a restaurant that typically served mostly white personnel, white customers. And he was married to the woman who was having lunch with her friends. And the server said that he needed to leave. And he was incredibly offended. And that server ended up being fired. And so you see management that will support employees who are doing the right things, will help train those who are not doing the right things, and stand by them and recognize their dignity and help them recognize that we support who you are, we give you the freedom to be who you are, and if you're not treated the way that we expect our employees to be treated, then we're going to do something about it.
We're talking a lot about the personal toll of burnout, but there's a huge economic toll to burnout too, and I can imagine for a restaurant, there, if your employees are burning out frequently because you're not giving them the kind of support they need or you're not taking care of them, there's an economic toll there as well, isn't there?
Oh, definitely. My background before I got my PhD in management is accounting. I have a master's degree in accounting and I worked in accounting. And there's one item that you never see on an income statement or a balance sheet represented anywhere, and it's this hidden cost of turnover. Most companies don't pay attention to it. The fact that every time you lose an employee, you have to incur a cost to replace them in search costs and training and replacement, the lost productivity of the knowledge your prior employee had. And most companies don't realize that even marginally higher rates of turnover in their employees result in millions of dollars of costs every year. There's a hotel chain that the Wall Street Journal reported on, the Joie de Vivre Hospitality Inc., that took over a series of boutique hotels in California. And their CEO, Chip Conley, the first thing they did is they came in and they bought brand new vacuums for all of the housekeeping staff, because their prior complaint over the several years is that management would never replace the vacuums despite their aging and not working anymore. So finally, new management comes in and provides new vacuums, and they replace them annually, and they're more attentive, to their employees' needs. And turnover dropped from over 66% down to 30%. And they estimated that this saved them nearly $5 million a year.
Which was much greater than the cost of new vacuums.
Exactly. And so businesses that get it know that keeping their employees happy, supporting them, will actually result in lower long-term costs, because you have fewer instances where you need to replace employees. They're more dedicated, more loyal. It takes an employer to show some loyalty first, though.
And Ben, I mean, you talked about people working 60 hours a week, companies that push their employees and want that kind of commitment. I can imagine that there's a toll there as well.
I think one of the sources of burnout has been our rising expectations about work and its place in our lives. That has changed. I'm a historian, and I write about changing patterns of work, but also changing beliefs about work. For a long time, 19th and 20th century, for the working class at least, work was more or less an end in itself. I'm sorry, a means to an end. Mm-hmm. Work to live, don't live to work, an old saying. Now, more and more, work becomes an end in itself. And we build myths, a lot of which we propagate and share at the university about work as a center of life, the answer to our problems as human beings. I tell my classes that we are led to believe that we will find a prince charming at work, some fairyland where we are happy and so forth. But instead, we find Dilbert. We're led to believe that at work we'll find justice, community, fulfillment, creativity, all of those things we would really like to have in our lives. As the last caller says, justice is often a failure. We don't find it there. And it's not just racism, but fairness. Basic issues of fairness are give way in jobs to profit. The bottom line is what work is about, not justice and fairness.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about job burnout this hour. With me, I have Ben Honeycutt. He is a leisure studies professor at the University of Iowa and author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream, and Ian Crawford, assistant professor of management and organization at the Tippie College of Business at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about job burnout as we wrap up our summer series, Iowa at Work Today. Coming up at noon on River to River, the final installment in the series, we'll take a look at dangerous jobs. With me right now, Ian Crawford, assistant professor of management and organization at the Tippie College of Business at the University of Iowa. Also, Ben Honeycutt, professor of leisure studies at the University of Iowa and author of Free Time, The Forgotten American Dream. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jesse is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Jesse.
Hi.
And this is a topic that's pretty close to your heart as well. Can you tell me about your experience?
Well, I have done job bouncing. You know, you have a job, you get married, you end up doing something else, you have a job. I have worked for the past 9 years for a wonderful company that provides services to people who have disabilities. And it's a designated burnout job. These beautiful people, in the first place, it's a burnout job salary-wise. It's a burnout job in hours and in the just the physical thing of pushing wheelchairs and lifting ramps. And I took it on when I was in my started in my 70s, and I'm 79 now. And I had rotator cuff surgery in March. And during that time, all of a sudden, I realized how totally exhausted I had become. You love these people, you know, and you get really emotionally invested. And when you're emotionally invested, it gets harder. It's not really good to get that invested. But sometimes you can't help it.
And you've decided that now is a point to make a change as
well. Yeah, as of July 1st, I resigned from the position. Rotator cuff surgery can be a mean surgery. I had a wonderful surgeon, but it takes a while to heal. And so now I am basically unemployed and basically on Social Security, which is not the best position, nor the position I had wanted to be in my life.
Well, Jesse, I hope you get some well-deserved rest after this experience. And I want to talk about something Jesse's talking about, because she said, you know, she got very emotionally involved in her job, and that wasn't good in a way. But on the other hand, emotional involvement in your job can be a great thing as well. I want to talk about engagement. And I mean, that's something that's very important to a lot of us in our work. It's a very important to a lot of businesses. And Ian, from your perspective, can you define engagement in the workplace?
Yeah, the way I think about engagement is when people come to work and they really harness their full selves to their work roles, and they really display and employ all of their physical energy, but their mental energy as well, and their emotional energy. Also, I've heard it described as people who come to work and work with their head, their hands, and their heart. They've really invested their whole person in their work. And it's really important. I mean, a lot of research has shown that one of the major predictors of company success and individuals' own job performance is their willingness to invest their full selves in their work role. And it makes a big difference, not only in people just doing the regular job well, but also those who will go above and beyond and do the voluntary extra mile type things that no one's asking them to do, but will go a long way to help companies and individuals be successful.
All right. And statistics show that about 30% of the workforce is engaged by that definition?
Yeah, I think Professor Honeycutt here has some numbers from Gallup survey, about 31%.
Okay.
About half would say they're not really engaged, but not actively disengaged either. And the remainder, 20%, would be actively disengaged. Those you would probably say are most likely at risk for burnout.
All right. And engagement sounds great, right?
Well, I was going to talk about the statistics here. The International Classification of Diseases, listing burnout, talks about engagement as being the antithesis of burnout. So that's one way of thinking about it in defining engagement. But again, I think we're led to believe that I think it's a matter of balance after all, of optimal arousal. That's a psychological term. Finding a place of between extremes. Expecting too much from your job can be rising expectations will eventually crash. Putting your job in perspective, I think, is one secret to avoid
right.
burnout. And finding other things in your life that are rewarding, meaningful, that you can find community and so forth. Expecting all of those things at your job, putting all of your eggs in one basket and having no group outside, no interest outside, no family to go to and spend significant time with, I think is a recipe for burnout.
Yeah, I just want to add to that. When I teach my students, I want them to understand that it's more engaging to work in a job where you feel like you have purpose, but to avoid the trap of making work your life's purpose. I was really impressed with, I follow golf, and Cedar Rapids native Zach Johnson
yes.
just won the British Open. It's a huge deal for those that don't understand golf. One of the greatest accomplishments in life of a golfer. And when he was being credited in the post-tournament interview for this amazing accomplishment, he said, my real accomplishment is my family, my wife and my kids. And this is wonderful, but they're really what's my life purpose. And I was super impressed that he would acknowledge that. And so I think it's important to have meaning and purpose at work. But our other research has shown you can come to work and be engaged and give all of your energy, but if you don't take regular time to break that off and to psychologically and physically and emotionally detach from work and have regular periods of rest and recovery, you can't be on fire all the time. You'll burn out a lot
right.
quicker.
Well, and Ben, I mean, taking time off to rest and recover is something that we are horrible at in this country,
well,
right?
We're losing vacation days. We don't take our full vacations. On average, we lose 4 or 5 days of vacation throughout the nation on average. So,
and we get far less than people in other developed countries.
Exactly,
right?
we're the only nation in the developed country, except South Korea, that doesn't have legislated vacation time. The issue of overwork, I think, is still alive and well. It's been around since the 1990s in Juliet Shore's book, The Overworked American. But we still see the debate in our politics. I guess it was last week, was it Jeb Bush said we need to be working longer hours. It created quite a stir, I guess, in Washington. Hillary Clinton responded, of course, and said that American workers work longer than any other group, any other population of an industrial nation. She's right. We're working longer than any of the European nations. We take far fewer holidays. Again, I think this working longer and longer and longer, this upward trending of and retirement, the last caller, Janie, was it?
Jesse,
I'm sorry. We're retiring later and later. There was a time in the 1990s when retirement looked like, you know, we're going to retire earlier and earlier. But no, over the recent New York Times recently has talked about how that this is a trend now, that we're working longer and longer and retiring later and later.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation now. There are, as we've talked about, people in some fields who are more vulnerable to burnout than people in other fields. And nursing is one of those fields where people are very vulnerable to burnout. Thad Wilson is a nurse and executive associate dean at the College of Nursing at the University of Iowa. Hi, Thad.
Good morning, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. And nursing is a very high-stress job. Do you see a lot of burnout in the field?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What we're seeing are certainly much people are living a lot longer, and when they come to the hospital, they have many more complex chronic conditions than we used to see, and we're matching that with very sophisticated technology, medical advances, and patients who don't stick around long enough that you can actually get engaged with them. So I really appreciated the comments about the value of being engaged, and so new graduates right out of school are lasting maybe a year, two at the most, and we're seeing about a 30 or higher percent dropout, not only from where they work, but from the profession.
Wow. And that, of course, has implications for all of us, not just hospitals and people in the nursing field. So you have been involved in developing a program to try to prevent burnout in nurses. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a trend across the nation. It's not brand new, though we're doing it a little differently at Iowa. But it's similar to what people would think of when they hear of a medical residency, when physicians graduate and they have 3 years that they go kind of work into the profession. So what we're doing is a residency for nurses that for the first year that they're in the hospital or whatever setting they're in, they have additional education, they have support groups, they have others who will help them with the parts of being a nurse that we don't have the time to fit into our curriculum, such as really being a member of a team and how to talk with people on the phone and a whole variety of different things that nurses say that burn them out, because what they want to do is focus on a patient.
So with this program, what kind of changes have you seen in job satisfaction and burnout?
Well, the research would indicate that when a fully implemented residency program is in place, that it will cut your turnover rate in half or better. And so we're seeing instead of 30% turnover among those first 2 years, in many places we're seeing it down into the 10% turnover. And for every nurse that leaves and they have to hire a new one, the cost to the institution is somewhere between $10,000 and $80,000, depending on the unit that they're at a hospital. So it's a big savings.
And are you getting comments from nurses who maybe not even going through the program, but helping with the program, mentoring the younger nurses?
We really are. The program in Iowa, we're doing it with some online information because the rural access hospitals, the critical access hospitals in the rural areas don't have the money to really invest in a full-fledged residency program. So we're doing it with some online modules, and then they have individuals at their institutions that support them. And we're hearing both from the new graduates and from the people that are mentoring them that this is a wonderful opportunity to really put some things together that will help people stay engaged with their staff and with the people around them and problem solving. And we're seeing that the turnover rates are dropping.
And is there a conversation about work-life balance in this residency program? I'm sure that so many nurses give so much of themselves to their job that's a big part of the burnout.
It is covered. Time management, our module on time management includes a section on taking care of yourself. And it talks about the importance of finding time away from work, the challenge and the difficulty sometimes of letting go, because you really do have patients and you think about them and you care about them. And when you're not at work, you're still thinking and caring about them. And it's a challenge to let go and really spend time doing things for yourself. So that is a part of what we do.
Well, Thad, thank you so much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Thad Wilson is a nurse and executive associate dean of the College of Nursing at the University of Iowa. We're talking about a program to help prevent burnout in nurses. And Ben, I'd love to hear your take listening to a conversation about that program. And I know that you talk with your students a great deal about developing a work-life balance and figuring out what's important to them and putting their resources in the right place. I mean, is that something we need to be having a conversation about in every field?
I think so. I'm in leisure studies, so I've talked about this for a long time, the work-life balance. Again, it's a very individual thing. But again, it does have also a historical and social component. There's a pressure. In our culture, there's also from the employers to you need to work longer, especially the corporate culture, the last person out the door at night wins sort of thing. So there is that. It's not just a personal choice. There is this cultural thing, I think. We are a culture of work, and it's really hard to swim upstream against that. I think one of the healthy things that I would hope I would give to my students is sort of a bit of a critical attitude about that, that there are other ways of living one's life, that maybe selecting jobs, maybe that would be important. What about the work-life balance of potential employers? What will my life look like? Will I be eaten alive by my job? Will I be burned out by the time I'm 30? That sort of thing. So that's some of the advice I would like to think I've shared with my students.
Right. So that gives us some insight into what we can do to protect ourselves from burnout. We've got a couple of emails here. This one's from Sam. He says he really liked the job that he did, but got burned out over the pressures that management put on us to constantly grow the business. Budgets were thrown around daily, weekly, and monthly, and that was really tiring. We have another email from Pam in Newton. She says, I worked for 14 years at my job with so much satisfaction and success. Then there were changes, which reduced my authority in the office. It led to my supervisor getting essentially demoted, and she began to micromanage my job, questioning procedures I put in place years before and splitting my job description with a new hire. So she retired and is looking for something else. So we've talked about what we can take away as employees, but what about employers? I mean, we talked earlier about the tremendous cost of turnover and of treating your employees poorly.
Yeah, I think if I could boil it down to three major things that employers can help with. People want to have a sense of meaning or purpose in what they do, and employers can help in small conversations and in large meetings, help everyone see how what you do really contributes to the company and to the world and to people's lives and makes a difference. The second one I've touched on a little earlier is that sense of support.
Treating your employees with respect.
With respect, with dignity, giving them the freedom, the autonomy to go about the work the way that they can do best. You know, once you really start getting micromanaged, it's just incredibly demotivating. And you saw that in the change in the person who wrote the email. And the last one I think Thad touched on is when your employees have a sense of competence, that they know what to do and they feel that they're good at it versus having a real sense of ambiguity. I don't know what to do or I don't know how to accomplish things. If you as an employer can help them gain those skills that they need, many of them that are tacit, that are not taught in training programs, I really think that's a great thing they're doing with the College of Nursing in this residency program is for all of these many things you may not have learned in a nursing program, we're going to help you find a way to learn how to deal with these ambiguous situations for which there's often no policy, no manual, no guide. And it helps people be better at what they do, have much more support, and then they have this greater sense of meaning in what they do. And it helps them come to work much more engaged and decreases the likelihood that they'll burn out. And then the last thing I'll say is if managers can really encourage their employees to go home and take a real break, turn off your smartphone. I don't expect you to check the email, and I don't want to see you or hear from you until tomorrow. Let them take breaks.
Ian Crawford, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Ian Crawford is Assistant Professor of Management and Organization at the Tippey College of Business at the University of Iowa. Ben Honeycutt, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Ben Honeycutt is Professor of Leisure Studies at the University of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. On the job.